You're tuned to Tidings from Hazel Khan. My guest today is Tom Damiani, a man who loves birds and who has devoted a great deal of his life to protecting them. Inspired by a field guide that helped him identify his first bird, a fox sparrow, in the fields around Bridgeport, Connecticut, where he was born, Tom has worked and volunteered for many organizations, always on the lookout for ways to expand his relationship to the natural world. Tom has been a board member for Long Island's North Fork Audubon Society since 1994 and steward of the Endangered Species Project, which is a DEC-mandated program contracted by Southold Town Hall to North Fork Audubon Society. Tom tells us about the long and winding road that brought him to where he is today.
Spring came around and somebody said they were looking for volunteers to do piping plover monitoring in Fairfield County in Connecticut. So I called up the director of the program, Julie Zickafoos, who worked for the Nature Conservancy at the time, and she got me going, and I just got completely into it. That's all I could do, and I was constantly out on the beaches looking for nesting plovers and finding a nest and calling her up, and she would come and confirm. And back in those days, that was in 1985, back in those days, they didn't disclose and do all the kind of stuff they're doing now. It was a lot different then. So I worked that year as a volunteer, and then the next year I was hired by the Nature Conservancy to do as the tern and plover warden out at Milford Point, which is also in Connecticut. I was hired to do that. So that was my first job at the Nature Conservancy. After that, I had a lot of different jobs, but trying to keep it all in the same vein, basically, in environmental. I did a nuisance wildlife control job, my own business, for 4.5 years, which is taking nuisance wildlife and relocating them. My name of my business was Wildlife Relocation. And a myriad of other volunteer positions that I kept, because I kept trying to move forward. Eventually, in 1986, or actually, yeah, 86 was my first job. Eventually, up to 1990 now we are, I said, I really need to go to school to get something on paper to show that I've got some higher education in this field, even though I've done had a lot of experience. So I ended up going to California to Columbia College, and the program there that I ended up getting certified in was Natural Resources Interpretation. So I became a certified Natural Resources Interpreter. And then in 1994, I applied for the job over at Meshamek Preserve on Shelter Island, which is a Nature Conservancy Preserve. And I've been working there ever since. I'm into my 17th year now as the Visitor Center Coordinator there.
So that's a real paid job. It's not a volunteer job.
Right. It's an actual paid. It's like, well, it was my living until they cut my hours last April down to 3 days a week. So then I have to do other things to supplement my income. But it originally was a summer job. And then I said, I'd like to stay on. So they offered me weekends and a place to live on the preserve. They did that for a couple of years. Eventually I got on full time. I think it took about 4 years for them to hire me full time.
You've done it all. I mean, you've been a volunteer and you've been paid to do this work. I have personally a very personal interest in the whole idea of volunteers. I think they're not only the salt of the earth, but I think our society, certainly this society, would not function well without volunteers.
That's right. I was going to say, I have a lot of volunteers that work with me at Meshamek Preserve as well. At the Visitor Center, there's near 30 volunteers that either come once a week or are on call. And I always tell them, we do an appreciation dinner in October, and I always tell them that they are sharing their most precious resource, which is their time. There's nothing more precious than the time.
Yes, but you've done it yourself for many years. But the thing is that it shouldn't be you, or your organization, whichever it may be, that appreciates the volunteers. It should be the larger society, and that's part of the problem. But I guess when to be truly appreciated, one gets paid. So if society really appreciated volunteers, they'd be paying them.
No, I was going to say, what's interesting is I go to a lot of these workshops and conferences and things on volunteer coordinators. A lot of the volunteers that have been volunteering their time or donating their time, and they coined the phrase of war generation. Okay, so people in 70s, 80s, that basic age group. And it was a different time, like around World War II, where people pitched in and did whatever it took for the war effort. And gave up a lot and sacrificed and gave their time. And they say that the face of volunteerism is changing in that now it's the baby boomer generation that the volunteers are going to be coming from, because obviously the war generation people are passing away. And it's different in that a lot of the baby boomers or professional people are looking to get something in return, not necessarily money, but to get some experience, to get some sort of acknowledgement. There's a lot of reasons why people volunteer. But it was interesting, and I hadn't really thought of that, because most of my volunteers are older people, mm-hmm. and the younger ones are more difficult to get on board, you know, and a lot of them have to work, number one, so they don't have the time. But I do find that the kids especially, they're coming in because they need points for something or some sort of experience for school, or, you know, so they're coming in for reasons. They're coming in, they have a reason to be there, not so much they want to just give their time, although there are kids that do it. You know, and there are national organizations out there to recognize volunteers and things like that, and there's, you know, National Volunteer Day. And
but maybe these younger ones who are doing it for more pragmatic reasons, I don't know, maybe mm-hmm. it's enough that just getting the credit or whatever it is that they're needing, you know, for whatever. Mm-hmm. Maybe that's enough of a reward, or maybe they need to be recognized and rewarded in different ways than the war generation. I mean, maybe the concept of service in itself is not enough.
Right. And like, that's why they always, when I go to these workshops and conferences and things, volunteer appreciation is a huge part of it, because you have to recognize the people. And it's interesting, because I just went to the last one I went to, they had a panel of actual volunteers up there, but a lot of them said they didn't care about the acknowledgement. Mm-hmm. They didn't want it. They didn't want the big ballyhoo, and they didn't want all this big fuss made over what they're doing. They're doing it because they want to do it. So I found that interesting. But you know, and we kept saying it, the volunteer coordinators and some of the volunteers themselves, because but it's nice to do, isn't it? It's not necessary. So who knows? You know.
Mm. Yeah. Who knows? Yeah. Yeah, you won't know till you don't do it. Mm-hmm. But nobody's going to say, I'm not going to become a volunteer because they don't have a volunteer appreciation program. They're not going to say that.
Right.
I first met Tom when I volunteered to be on the Plover Patrol team. When I told people about the program, some scoffed and disparaged it, saying, well, what would the plovers do if you didn't protect them? They'd die, right? So let nature take its course. Others thought it was a wonderfully uplifting project that people and the state of New York would go to so much trouble to protect these small birds from extinction. This is Tidings, and you're listening to Tom Damiani talk about birds and bird protection programs in our neighborhood on Long Island.
I guess I'm asking you, why do you bother? Or what, you know, why do you personally bother?
Yeah, that's a good question. And, you know, and I was going around spouting, I said, what better work could we be doing than preserving an endangered species? You know, I mean, I kind of get the whole web of life. I understand that when a piece disappears, it weakens the web that much more. And quite frankly, I don't really care about how it affects me or how it affects people, because a lot of times people will take the viewpoint of, well, you know, they're indicator species. If they go, it's going to affect us. And I don't even care about that. I don't look at the human species as the end all, and that's how, you know, we're it. To me, it's everything is precious. All life needs to be preserved as best we can. I mean, I step on an ant occasionally, I kill bees, you know, but overall, I do believe that all the different life forms on this planet deserve to be protected if they need to be protected, and it's sacred. So to me, it's like I am going out there. I'm protecting endangered species. I'm trying to spread the word. I'm trying to get more people involved as much as I can, plus doing all the grunt work that I do, and it's very rewarding. At the end of the day, I feel like, boy, this is far better than anything else that I've done. Look. Yeah, and you're right. I mean, and as I'm saying this, I'm thinking you're right, because there's you're going against the tide. It's like it's shoveling, you know what, against it. So it's you're absolutely correct on that. And I do get like that. I do feel like sometimes like what this is ridiculous. You're breaking your hump to do this, yet you get so many people not getting it and not really caring and actually working against you, whether it's unconscious or consciously working against you what you're trying to do. And it is very difficult, but I think that you just have to keep it in mind. I keep in my mind that it's important work. It needs to be done, and we can't let this happen. We can't let a species disappear because people don't understand or don't care.
But do you have these kinds of conversations either with volunteers or at these volunteer dinners or recognition things? Do you actually say these things or?
Yeah, I do. In my emails to the volunteers this year, to the plumber volunteers, mm-hmm. I reiterated many times about how important this work is and how it's such a wonderful thing to do, to be doing whatever you can do. You don't have to be out there every day or once a week. You're making some contribution. I have homeowners that are not volunteers that have called me up and said, this is happening, and I'd call the DEC police and they'd get over there and handle it. So thank God that she called for that one incident.
What might be an incident?
One incident was a woman was out there with her dog, and she was sitting under the umbrella as the dog walked up and down the beach going into the fenced areas. And, obviously the birds are freaking out, especially the terns and the plovers as well running around. So she called me. I called DEC police. And he was able to get over there. She had moved at this point, but he followed the tracks from the umbrella to her house. And he went and he told her, he said, these birds are protected by law. If you bring any harm to them, you can be fined or jailed. So you really have to keep this dog under your control. And she goes, oh, no, it was just one time. And, everybody always says that was just for a couple of minutes. Mm-hmm. So everybody has that excuse when it comes to dogs on the beach. Nobody ever says, yeah, well, too bad. But anyway, so I was so happy that she called me, and I told her, I said, call me anytime. I said, I maybe can do something about it.
Well, and so, maybe the dog owner also learned something from it,
Absolutely. Even if she didn't completely understand that they're being protected and that the dog, alarms them to the point where they could actually abandon nest, young could be stepped on or eaten or whatever, hopefully, or maybe she just got scared a little bit about, if I do this, I'm going to be fine. But, if that's all it takes, if that's right. What it takes, that's fine too.
Why don't you actually describe the program? Because we've not actually talked about it.
Well, the program, the ESP for North Fork Audubon, anyway, the ESP, the endangered, I like to call it the Endangered Species Program rather than Project. We originally called it Project, but I like Program better. We have about 22 sites on the North Fork. They're all beaches, okay, and they could be on the Sound side or the Bay side. And these sites, I don't know how exactly they targeted them. They did all this when I wasn't involved in the program, but it must have been where there was enough suitable habitat for nesting and or feeding, foraging. And we have to cover these 22 sites. I don't know exactly what the contract says, how many times we're supposed to visit them in a season. I don't think there's a set number, but we have to look at them enough times during the year to determine whether there's anything nesting there, either plovers or terns. And then if we do find either one of those birds nesting there, then we have to get it protected with string fencing. And then if it's a plover nest, usually 9 times out of 10, you're going to exclose it with turkey wire exclosure so that nothing can get at them. And also there's a netting that goes over the top of the exclosure to keep avian predators from going down into the exclosure. The plovers are able to walk in and out of it. They prefer to walk on the ground than fly. So we have to get that protected. And then the monitoring is at least once a week, preferably twice or even 3 times a week, getting out to the site and checking it to see how the birds are coming along, if they're still on the nest. Eventually, the birds will hatch. We have to note that in our monitoring schedule and our report. And then we have to follow those young, those plover young, until they actually fledge, because they hatch, and it takes about a little over a month for them to actually be able to fly. So they're running around on the beach for 30 days before they can actually fly. So they're really, it's a good possibility something can happen to them, and something usually does. Either they get predated upon, they starve. There's so many different ways they can go.
And they're also very small.
Yeah, they are. They're very small, and they starve.
Yeah.
They're called precocial young, and precocial meaning that as soon as they hatch, they're feeding on their own. The parents never feed a morsel. They show them what to eat. And within 24 hours or 48 hours, they're already feeding on their own and running around on the beach with the parents. So pretty amazing, really.
So the volunteers fill out these monitoring reports and send them
right,
to you.
Right, yeah, they're called daily site visits. Forms, and they fill them out every time they go. You fill one out and then send it to me so that I can get a handle on what's going on and how often the site is being monitored, how often people are going there. And then I put a weekly report in from there, and eventually a mid-season report, and then end of the season report.
Have you done your final season report yet?
No, I haven't done that yet. Terns aren't done here yet on our beaches. They still have young.
How much longer is the time?
Oh, it can't be more than a week or so.
Uh-huh.
And then it'll be finished.
So looking back over this season, how was this season compared to other seasons?
Well, I didn't go through all the historical data. I frankly haven't had time to do all that, but last year was similar to this year. I looked at 2009, and it was very similar to, as far as the number of pairs and the fledged young from the plovers. I think this year, just preliminarily speaking, per pair, it's going to be about 1.08 young per pair.
And so they're not reproducing. They're not reproducing themselves then.
No, they're not. I mean, maybe in some places they are, but certainly here, not in the North Fork, they have not. And last year they didn't as well. It was probably something very similar to about one bird per pair.
So how many pairs altogether? People need to understand what the scope of this is that we're talking about.
Yeah, we had 9 pair of plovers nesting on the North Fork sites and the 22 sites.
Only 9 pair?
Right. And three of those, was really neat, three of those were on one beach at Gull Pond in Greenport, which is great. That was a really great spot this year, and it fledged a lot of terns as well. About 30 or 40 tern young came out of that beach too, so that was really good. But yeah, so when you look at the birds, I mean, there's only about, I can't remember exactly the number. I think I was going to say 200 pair on Long Island. I'm not sure on that number. The Eastern Seaboard, I think there's something like 800 pair, and I think on Long Island, it's 200, something like that.
So where are plover central? I mean, where are they concentrated? Which is a good part of the United States for these birds?
Yeah, well, I would imagine if you could go up and down the Atlantic Seaboard, you would think that the areas they'd be doing the best would be the less populated areas or islands, those kind of places. I don't offhand, top of my head, know the best place for plovers, like as far as the state goes. Mm. But you can imagine Long Island with the development and the beach use here and the population, how difficult it must be for these birds to feel, comfortable enough to be able to nest. So they feel good about it. Because, when they get back here, it's March. So you figure March, they're here. Not a lot of people on the beaches in March and April, and then they start to nest. If you're lucky, they'll lay their 4 eggs in April, and they're out. By June, they're done. They're fledged. But for some reason, that rarely happens. So you often have baby plovers on the beaches, young plovers on the beaches, when there's people starting to come, and people are walking their dogs, and there's all kinds of activities going on. So it's very difficult for these birds to find a safe haven to actually nest and raise their young.
I was just going to say, for 9 pair, are some of them singles and they don't have pairs, or doesn't that count?
No, those are all birds. I'm saying 9 that actually laid eggs.
I see.
those nine paralate eggs.
So if there were
the young did not make it.
I see. Oh, I see. But if there were other ones, there weren't. I mean, that's in other words, there were only 18 birds. I mean, before they fledged,
right?
On the 22 beaches, so some had none at all.
Yeah, some had none at all. Most had none at all.
I see. Wow.
There's 22 sites, but only seven of them are actually active at any with anything like terns or plovers.
So sometimes it must be difficult to keep encouraged. Keep your spirits
What's
up.
That?
It must be difficult sometimes to remain positive when the numbers are so small. Yeah.
Absolutely. I try to focus on what's going on. I focus on the active sites. I focus on, you know, just trying to be as positive as possible and to hope for the best. And then when something bad happens, you're really disappointed. Mm-hmm. I would imagine that the longer you do this, the easier it is to you know, these things happen, like, you know, they have four young and 3 days later all four are gone, and not to be devastated by that. The longer you probably do this, the more you expect, like, you know, when it doesn't happen, you're, you know, thrilled, but you almost expect them not to make it.
Not to take it personally.
Yeah, right. Yeah, you can't at all. And you know, the hardest part is, as far as taking it personally, is when you go on the beach and you run into people that are kind of hostile, and that's hard for me to not take that personally.
Because, yeah.
You know, it's like an attack on me. You know what I'm saying? You're trying to do a job. It's like if you're trying to do your job in your office and somebody's in there blocking your way or telling you, you know, you can't do it.
So, Tom, what does a plover or plover, what does a piping plover sound like? Can you make the sound?
It's kind of like a, I mean, I can get it better.
Yeah.
It's a peep low is what the first one, that's where the whole name piping comes, sounds pipe-like that. They usually do that. Usually that's an alarm call. They do that to warn their mate or their young that there's danger. Somebody's coming down the beach and, you know, there's a dog or a person or something, whatever they don't like. And they're going to start with that like that. And then usually what the young do is they freeze or they'll squat down on the ground. When they're really little, they squat. When they're older, they just stop. They don't move. And then what the adult will do is they'll start running along the beach and try to attract whoever it is, the dog, the person, the gull, whatever might eat the young, to try to attract them away from that area. They'll just start walking along the ground. Sometimes they'll even act like they've got a broken wing. They'll kind of drag their one wing along and flutter on the ground as though they can't fly. And I've seen it work. I've seen it work with gulls. They go right after that adult, thinking, oh, boy, easy meal, can't fly. And then after the adult's got them a little bit away, it'll just fly away and leave them there, and then the young run the other way.
What does a tern sound like?
That's more difficult. It's pretty funny, because this year what it sounded like to me was there's an Ozzy Osbourne song. Mm-hmm. And he goes, I like that in the song, and that's what the turn something. I when they're really agitated, they start with this I sound, and they start to dive bomb you, and they actually squirt. I've had a couple of them squirt their excrement on me, almost like an archer, get me right where they wanted to get me. You know, in the arm, right in the center of the chest, on top of the head. They know exactly what they're doing. And they do that to, it's kind of, you know, it doesn't really smell, but I guess it's not a real pleasant thing for some things to get squirted on by the adult. So it seems to be effective for probably against some predators.
But it's to protect their nest. It's when
they do that. Their nest or young, yeah, exactly.
Can you do some other bird sounds? Owls, okay.
Yeah, I can do a lot of owl sounds, yeah. I can do the screech owl, which is... And then I can do the great horned owl. That one.
Mm-hmm.
I can do a catbird.
Okay. Yes, do a catbird because wait, do it again.
Yeah, the kids love that one.
What do they look like, catbirds?
They're all gray. They're smaller than a robin. They're all gray. They're in the mimic family, so they're similar in shape to a mockingbird, but smaller, all gray, and they've got kind of a rusty undertail covert around the vents, they call it, just underneath the tail where the tail meets the body. It's kind of like a reddish, rusty color. And a little blackish cap they have, the black catbird does. Like I said, it's a mimic, so it actually will use other birds, like little parts of other birds' songs, like fragmented phrases, and they'll go through this whole thing. It usually just sounds like a kind of a squeaky thing, but when you listen to it, you'll hear little bits and pieces of other birds in there.
Is that why they do they mimic cats, or that's just by chance that they're called catbirds?
It's by chance, yeah. I think it's just I think more or less it's their alarm call when they do that. When they start with that stuff, that means something's going on they don't like.
But they're not actually mimicking cats like they're mimicking other birds.
No, that'd be a good question too, because since they are the mimic family, they're not a very good mimic though. They can mimic, but they're not that good.
Is there any other one? Any other? Just do two more before we end.
Well, I can do the barred owl.
Mm-hmm.
And that, what that bird's saying is, who cooks for you? Who cooks for you all? I guess they're down south. A lot of them down there.
Oh, we don't have them here?
We do. Yeah, actually, in Connecticut. They're not on Long Island, as far as I know. But Connecticut's got them, and there's a lot of them down south.
Okay, we just do one more. One more local one, maybe. Do ospreys have a sound?
Yeah, osprey. Kind of like that. And then when they're, that's their, that's usually when they're flying, they call the fish flight. The male has a fish in his talons, and he's flying around trying to attract a female or whatever. And then they have this other one. It's more of a, when they don't like what's getting near the nest as a predator or a person walking like that. And they do that, and then they'll do this kind of a sound. I don't know how good that is, but something like that anyway.
So in order to reproduce these sounds, I mean, that it's a talent to be able to do that. Is it that you hear that it's because you can hear them or because you can reproduce them? I mean, I guess it's both.
It is. And I think the big reason why I'm so oral about birds, and I really do like to, I like the bird songs and like to try to remember them and be able to reproduce them and things like that, is because I'm a musician. I've always been a musician.
I was going to
play
ask
the band
you.
Since I was 12 years old. So it's music, you know.
What do you play?
Well, I'm a singer.
Oh.
I used to play drums and sing in bands, and then I was a better singer than a drummer, so they got a drummer, and then I ended up being the singer. So now that's what I do now. I do with my DJ. I'm called the singing DJ, and I've been singing since I was 12 years old.
Do you need bird songs when you're doing your DJing?
I never incorporate the bird songs into the DJ.
Well, this is great. Thank you very much, Tom.
That was Tom Damiani on Tidings from Hazel Khan. He told us about protecting endangered piping plovers and terns on the beaches of Long Island's East End. And then he regaled us by imitating a variety of bird calls. Tidings can be heard on WPKN 89.5 Bridgeport on the second Wednesday of each month at 6:30 p.m. and streaming on WPKN.org. Tidings is produced by Tony Ernst.